Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Steve Rendell, here with Peter Hart. This week on Counterspin, immigration policy is big news this week with a legislative battle in Washington and massive demonstrations for immigrants' rights across the country. But there are still substantial gaps in the media discussion of the issue. We'll try to fill in those missing pieces with Andrea Batista Schlesinger of the Drum Major Institute. Also on Counterspin today, it's common knowledge that newspaper companies are slashing jobs throughout the country. So when a veteran reporter in Vermont was abruptly fired, it made news. What did Christopher Graff do that upset his bosses at the Associated Press? We'll ask columnist Peter Frain from the paper 7 Days. All that's coming up, but first we'll take a look back at the week's press.
Here we go again. Supporters of the Iraq War are falling back on the theory that the war's not actually going as badly as it seems. No, the real problem is the news media's relentless negativity. This round seemed to kick off with right-wing talker Laura Ingraham's appearance on NBC's Today Show, where she laid out her case by, among other things, calling for Today host Matt Lauer to go to Iraq, something he'd already done. This wasn't Ingraham's first dubious pronouncement on the subject. On Fox's The O'Reilly Factor on February 14th, she claimed that journalists could tell the good news if they wanted, citing ABC's Bob Woodruff's decision to go out with Iraqi security forces as an example. Woodruff, of course, was nearly killed in the process. This kind of criticism is hardly worth responding to seriously. But that didn't stop ABC's Good Morning America from devoting segments on March 22nd and 23rd to addressing the concerns of their viewers, who think they're somehow hiding the good news. Often these critics suggest that the media should spend more time covering the reconstruction projects, which would show the positive side of the war. But there are some other factors worth considering. For starters, the former press attaché at the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad told the American Journalism Review that U.S. officials stopped taking reporters out on such trips for fear of making reconstruction projects targets for insurgents. And even more importantly, consider a recent USA Today report, which recalled some unpleasant facts about the state of reconstruction in Iraq. Electricity production is lower than before the war. Only about a third of the scheduled water projects were completed, and just 77,000 jobs were created, far below the 1.5 million projected. Those figures all come from the U.S. government. If anything, more media coverage of reconstruction would make things in Iraq sound even worse. But critics like Laura Ingraham could blame the media for that, too.
A few weeks ago on Counterspin, we talked about yet another explosive memo from the run-up to the Iraq War. First reported in the February 3rd edition of the London Guardian, the memo of a January 2003 meeting between George W. Bush and British Prime Minister Tony Blair showed the White House was set to invade Iraq no matter what the status of Iraq's weapons of mass destruction. This memo, in some respects, was similar to other leaked documents, including one known as the Downing Street Memo. But there's one big difference. This memo was covered on the front page of the New York Times on March 27th. And with the Times seal of approval, it was picked up around the media, where some outlets promptly blew the story. On CBS Evening News, anchor Russ Mitchell said that, quote, "This memo seems to indicate, once again, that going into the war, the British and the Americans had bad intelligence," close quote. CBS reporter Lara Logan agreed, but talked only about the revelation that Bush didn't think there would be ethnic or religious conflict in Iraq. That's an important point, but surely not the most damning information. On NBC Nightly News, anchor Brian Williams explained that the story was from the Now It Can Be Told file, though why it could only be told a month after it was first told wasn't clear. Equally unclear was reporter Andrea Mitchell's comment that the White House, quote, said that the president's public and private comments were fully consistent, close quote. As Greg Mitchell of Editor and Publisher pointed out, statements by Bush and Blair after their meeting directly contradict the memo. So someone's not telling the truth. You'd like to think there is some appetite in the press to figure out who's lying.
Senator Russ Feingold's call to censure George W. Bush seems, on its face, a worthy subject of discussion. Feingold argues that since Bush's NSA wiretapping plan violates existing law, the Congress should take this symbolic action to register its disapproval. But much of the media coverage has focused squarely on the political wisdom or the strategic value of Feingold's move instead of the law. LA Times reporter Ron Brownstein captured some of that media conventional wisdom in a March 26th piece, writing, quote, "It's an understatement to say Feingold's proposal doesn't fit with his party's emerging election strategy. In a narrow sense, many Democrats would rather focus on Iraq than on the NSA surveillance, on which polls show Bush enjoys greater support," close quote. As we've said here before, reporters should be wary of assuming anything about the public support for Bush's wiretapping. Some polls suggest that when asked whether Bush had the legal authority to do this, most people say no. But if we're talking polls, why not cite a poll about censure? Brownstein never addressed it, but a recent Newsweek poll asked that very question and found that the censure of Bush had 42% support overall and 60% support from Democrats. Feingold's censure resolution, then, seems to follow a trend. It's an idea that sounds too radical for our pundits, but has significant public support nonetheless.
The International Atomic Energy Agency, or IAEA, held a secret meeting in mid-March to brief members, including the U.S., about the state of Iran's nuclear weapons program. Following the meeting, according to American arms experts David Albright and Corey Hinterstein, quote, "Anonymous U.S. officials quickly started to distort what the IAEA had said. These officials told journalists on a not-for-attribution basis that action by Iran represented a significant acceleration of its enrichment program," close quote. According to the two, who published a report about the meeting on the website of the think tank, the Institute for Science and International Security, quote, "U.S. officials called several journalists to tell them that in the briefing, IAEA officials were shocked, astonished, and blown away by Iran's progress on gas centrifuges, leading the United States to revise its own timeline for Iran to get the bomb," close quote. In fact, Albright and Hinterstein reported, quote, "IAEA officials have said they were not surprised by Iran's actions," close quote. Well, when fair checked to see if any American media outlets had repeated the official distortions, we were able to find just one story, an Associated Press report by George John, which reported that U.S. officials claimed the IAEA had been blown away by Iran's nuclear progress. But John also reported that IAEA officials were furious at U.S. officials' distortions, citing one saying, quote, "It comes from people who are seeking a crisis, not a solution," close quote. This episode shows that official deception is alive and well. By exposing officials who are trying to deceive the public, John and the Associated Press got the story just right.
And finally, the March 24th TV Guide has an interview with right-wing Fox personality and syndicated radio host Sean Hannity, where he expresses a degree of fondness for Howard Stern, but notes one crucial difference between himself and the shock jock. Quote, "The only difference between his path and my path was he was talking about lesbians and strippers, and I was praising Ronald Reagan," close quote. Actually, Hannity did spend a fair amount of time talking about lesbians in his early days in radio on UC Santa Barbara's KCSB. After airing for less than a year, Hannity's weekly show was canceled in 1989 when KCSB management charged him with discriminating against gays and lesbians. That was after he aired two shows featuring the book The AIDS Cover-Up, The Real and Alarming Facts About AIDS, and its homophobic Christian right activist author Gene Antonio. At one point, according to the campus newspaper The Daily Nexus, Hannity declared, quote, "Anyone listening to this show that believes homosexuality is a normal lifestyle has been brainwashed. It's very dangerous if we start accepting lower and lower forms of behavior as the normal," close quote. When a fellow KCSB broadcaster called the show to challenge the host and his guest, Hannity pointed out that the caller, a lesbian, had had a child through artificial insemination, while Antonio chimed in calling the child a turkey baster baby. When the caller took issue with the disgusting remark, Hannity responded, quote, "I feel sorry for your child," close quote. Too bad TV Guide couldn't capture Hannity's mean-spirited nature and penchant for twisting the truth. But then the magazine is owned by News Corp, the parent company of Fox News, the cable channel where Hannity made his name.
Thanks, Peter. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group, FAIR. FAIR also publishes a magazine called Extra. I'll be giving subscription information for Extra later on in the show.
Immigration is once again squarely in the media spotlight. There are dueling legislative proposals in Washington, along with considerable political jockeying, particularly on the Republican side. But what's the state of the debate over immigration, legal and illegal? Are there ideas about how to deal with immigration that so far fall outside the parameters of the media debate? Joining us now to talk about this is Andrea Batista Schlesinger, Executive Director of the Drum Major Institute here in New York City. Andrea, welcome to Counterspin.
Thank you.
Now, this is an issue where the range of debate in the media is often quite narrow, from the far right to what you might call the corporate-friendly or business-friendly right. This was evident on ABC's Good Morning America this week. They spent one segment talking to right-wing pundit Sean Hannity. The next day, perhaps for balance, they talked to Republican Senator John McCain. Talk a little bit about this facet of the conversation over immigration.
Well, the first thing is I don't think it's unique to immigration. I think there's a tendency in general by the mainstream media to look at most policy debates as a conversation between special interests. Mm-hmm. This is especially true with immigration. You know, what we're trying to talk about is how the larger perspective of American workers, because they do not comprise a special interest group, is not being heard.
Now, on the other side of this, if you think about balancing those perspectives with some other perspective, you do get a sense in sort of broad terms that there isn't a real coherent left or progressive position on the issue of immigration. There's certainly room for debate. That doesn't let the press off the hook, but I know you've written about this. What could such a position look like if it were articulated?
Well, our argument is that progressives are missing a huge opportunity here. And one of the things that in the broader political landscape we've been obsessed with is how do we connect with that vast middle? How do we connect with the people who are simply trying to work for a living, make enough money to retire, to send their kids to college? And there's an argument here, a proactive argument, that progressives can make, which is that the right kind of immigration policy is actually key to middle-class economic security. And what we did is set up a litmus test for what a piece of legislation would have to do in order for it to be good for the middle class. But it's unfortunate that progressives have been kind of content to wait until perhaps they're expecting the right will implode on this. And that defensive stance really misses an opportunity to talk to a whole swath of people who are actually anxious to share their concerns, who don't want to be called xenophobes just because they are concerned of the impact of immigration on their own jobs, but who, when presented with the information and the facts, on balance, would be more interested in an argument from the left than from either the extreme right border control, get on a horse with a gun folks, or the, you know, big business folks that they're feeling the squeeze from anyway.
Now, your group did sort of grade some of the proposals so far, the more punitive proposal from the House, and also there have been some from the Senate. How do you see this legislation as it currently stands today as we speak?
Well, there are two pieces of legislation on the table. One is still the House bill, and the House bill is Sensenbrenner's, you know, lock up the borders and that legislation. And, you know, in our view, however the right may think that that's what people want to hear, in reality, doesn't address their economic concerns at all. And, you know, our litmus test is twofold. We tried to keep it simple here. Any piece of immigration policy has to do two things. First, it has to recognize that immigrants, legal and illegal, play a critical role in the economy. The current and aspiring middle class rely on the services that they provide. We rely on the taxes that they pay into the system. We certainly are beneficiaries of the businesses and the entrepreneurial spirit that they bring here. And so any bill that says, let's just round them up and get rid of them, actually is bad for the middle class bottom line. The second test is, does an immigration bill strengthen the workplace rights of legal and illegal immigrants? Our view is anything short of that creates this kind of race to the bottom where, of course, an employer is going to pick somebody who has no rights over somebody who has basic workplace rights because if you have a choice between exploiting someone and not, big business is going to pick exploitation. And that's bad for the middle class and those who are trying to work their way into the middle class. So we graded bills based on those two tests and those two principles for legislation that would be in the best interest of the middle class. And frankly, everything on the table is lacking, but Sensenbrenner's bill is entirely misses the point when it comes to what middle class families care about.
And that's, of course, H.R. 4437, which in, I think, a lot of ways inspired a lot of the protests that we saw in the streets against this immigration legislation. Well, the context of this discussion, of any discussion really about immigration, is often economics. New York Times columnist Paul Krugman, who's a favorite of liberal readers, seem to endorse the position that, yes, on balance, immigrants hurt U.S.-born workers. That caused Tony Blankley of the conservative Washington Times to write shortly thereafter that, hey, look, Krugman's on our side. Robert Samuelson, he's the columnist on economics from the Washington Post. He basically agrees with the sort of conservative argument on this. How do you see this part of the debate over immigration in terms of economic effect? What kind of evidence is perhaps being overlooked?
Well, it's kind of funny. It's like that, you know, nobody goes there anymore. It's too crowded. Well, of course, under the current system, which doesn't work, it's designed for there to be a competition between exploited workers, immigrant workers who have no rights, and working Americans. And so you've got these jobs where there are no legal protections. So, of course, they're going to take jobs away from the middle class and for working Americans. So, you know, it's kind of Krugman, unfortunately, missed the point, which is that everybody needs and everybody wants better immigration policy because we have to deal with that reality, the reality that if we have, as we do, an underclass of workers, that's what is meant by, you know, the idea everybody says immigrants are living in the shadows, you know, folks who are not in the mainstream. If you have workers that have no rights, they are going to be taking jobs away because it's less expensive for the big business bottom line. So Krugman's right, but he misses the point. He doesn't locate the context, the conversation as evidence as opposed to a conclusion.
You do see some research that points to what might be a net gain from immigration, legal and illegal, to the total economy in the form of taxes, particularly Social Security taxes, that immigrants pay into the system that they don't extract.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the one major study that was done that compared immigrants providing, mm-hmm. immigrants' taxes paid versus the services they receive found a net gain in terms of taxation. Certainly, the young population of immigrants contributes greatly to the Social Security system. There was a study done by the National Foundation for American Policy mm-hmm. that found that if you reduced legal immigration by a third, actually, any middle class people making at least $60,000 would have to pay $600 more in taxes over the next 10 years in order to make up for that shortfall. So it would actually impact the current and aspiring middle class in terms of even keeping the Social Security system solvent. They are home buyers. They provide demand for businesses. I mean, it is limitless the ways in which the presence of immigrants actually benefits the economy, besides the fact that, you know, they pick the food that the middle class eats, they clean the homes of, you know, the middle class. I mean, there are all of these ways in which immigrants contribute to the economy that make any proposal to kind of round them up and get rid of them ridiculous. Now, on the other hand, I do want to make this point. Progressives need not have a knee-jerk reaction to a conversation about whether or not immigration is impacting the job security of working Americans. And I've done a lot of radio shows in places like Montana or the Finger Lakes in upstate New York. And, you know, there's a sense and there's a hunger for those workers to be heard, but not to be accused of xenophobia in the process. Mm-hmm. And so there's a conversation there that the media could do a better job of facilitating and that progressives should certainly do a better job of engaging in.
Now, finally, there was obviously a significant amount of media attention paid to these quite massive protests against specifically the House bill, H.R. 4437, but I think more generally the protests were about this debate that's going on in Washington. Do you think these protests open up a little bit of space in the media that perhaps wouldn't be available to talk about some of these things, to talk about stories that otherwise wouldn't be told?
I do think that the protests help humanize the debate. Mm-hmm. And that's part of the way. But our argument would be that we've then got to humanize the American workers who have a vested interest in there being a resolution to the immigration crisis that actually meets their economic needs. So there's an opportunity there, of course. But there also needs to be an understanding, and I think if the media were to investigate this, they would find it, that there are people, working Americans, citizens, who are as interested in there being a resolution that doesn't round everybody up and get rid of them. And if the media would engage in that conversation, I think it could also shift the debate. So it's not just immigrants and protest versus Americans who want, you know, their borders to be safe. There's a joint interest in this conversation, a shared interest.
We've been speaking with Andrea Batista Schlesinger. She's the executive director of the Drum Major Institute. You can read their work online at drummajorinstitute.org. Andrea, thanks so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you very much.
There's a good chance you've never heard of Christopher Graff. He didn't spend his media career as a TV pundit or a high-profile foreign correspondent. But in the world of Vermont politics and media, Graff was something of a fixture, which explains why his sudden dismissal from his longtime job as Vermont bureau chief for the Associated Press raised so many eyebrows. What did Chris Graff do to get himself fired? And is there a larger lesson here about the state of the media? We're joined now by Peter Frayne. He's a columnist for the weekly paper 7 Days. He's been following this story. Peter Frayne, welcome to Counterspin.
Pleasure to be here.
Well, let's start with the obvious question, I guess. What happened here? We know there are at least two episodes that may have left some of his bosses at AP a little less than pleased. What were they?
The bombshell dropped on March 20th. That afternoon, Monday afternoon, word started getting around the State House in Montpelier and political circles that Chris Graff was fired at the AP Bureau. I would say 100% of the people reacted with total disbelief. Chris Graff has been an institution. He's been there since 1978. He has a solid reputation for fairness and integrity and honesty. He's treats all sides the same. So when an institution like that is fired, what happens? Well, we had letters from our governor, our congressional delegation, to Tom Curley, the head of AP. We've had editorials in our newspapers and columns written about this and just on the street uproar over what happened. We don't know what happened. AP won't say. Chris has no explanation, though he said he'd be happy to release any personnel records. He's not hiding anything. But we do know chronologically that the hammer dropped on Monday, March 20th, because of a column Christopher had put on the AP wire about 2 weeks previous as part of the Sunshine Week package. Openness in government was the theme. It's the second annual Sunshine Week. Chris included a column written by Democratic U.S. Senator Patrick Leahy of Vermont. He had done so the year before, in fact, column on the same theme. This time, that was what caused AP, at least as Chris was told, that column should not have run. Meeting was scheduled on the 20th, and when the call came from the AP brass that they'd rather meet him at the hotel and not the Montpelier Bureau, he knew the end was near.
There's also another story, and this one involves Fox News Channel's
yes,
Bill
does.
O'Reilly.
Recently, Chris Graff, back in January, actually made the national airwaves, at least on Fox News. Bill O'Reilly was on a personal crusade that month against a Vermont District Court judge who had given a sentence that, unfortunately, was misreported at first by some of our media outlets, but a sentence deemed too light for the defendant. O'Reilly wanted Judge Cashman's head and went after everyone and anyone who didn't agree with him. And in fact, most of the Vermont press did not agree with him. And what Chris Graff did to get himself in trouble was, following the misreports about the sentence and the judge allegedly saying he didn't believe in punishment, Chris got the court transcripts and 3 days later ran a story on the wire correcting the error of some Vermont media outlets that was certainly gasoline on the Fox News fire. That got Chris whacked a few times by name by the one and only.
Not a surprise there. And we should kind of note the irony here that feeding a column about the Freedom of Information Act during Sunshine Week, which is about open government, about the press, pressing on the government to be more open and accountable, that apparently is what offended someone at the AP. Now, the AP has read your piece. Actually, a lot of people have read your piece. They've responded, but as you note, they're not saying a whole lot in their response, are they?
No, they're not. They respond. Tom Curley responded to the letter from the congressional delegation very quickly, in fact, so quickly the AP was supposed to have at least notified them before it made the AP wire what Curley was saying. And Curley just dismissed it, basically said, it's none of your business. This is the law. This is, we're a private business. And get lost. It was, butt out. Very shocking, very surprising, you know, what's going on here. We don't know, really, and that's what's causing concern.
You did note in one of your pieces about this story that there's kind of a Gannett mentality that seems to be taking over at the AP.
Well, Curley comes from the world of Gannett, the marvelous world of Gannett. They own the largest paper in Vermont here in the Burlington Free Press. So over the years, I've had a taste of Gannett and the hundreds of reporters who've passed through the portals here in Vermont. There have been two other bureau chiefs, I've been told by AP folks, who have also, veteran folks around the country, who've gotten the axe lately. There's a sense, given ties, that this is the same kind of management that's made Gannett the great success it is financially. That's in play as a possibility, too.
Now, for those of us finally who live outside Vermont, we're looking for a lesson here. You mentioned this Gannett effect at the AP Bureau. Graph seems to be an institution in Vermont. Is there some lesson here? If it can happen to this guy, it can really happen to anyone in the media.
Well, the lesson is, I think, reflecting what we've seen in the last decade in the American press. People treasure their own personal daily paper, or even if it's online, it's what they go to every day. It's a ritual, it's a routine. And to find out that the real strings are pulled elsewhere, far, far from your local city, town, or state, is a bit frightening. And I think all Americans in or out of the press need to be aware of what's going on and speak out about it. And there's been a lot of speaking out in Vermont lately, and that's a healthy thing.
We've been speaking with Peter Frain. He's the Inside Track columnist for the 7 Days newspaper in Vermont. You can read his work online at their website, 7daysvt.com. Peter Frain, thanks for joining us here on Counterspin.
My pleasure.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the staff and interns at the Media Watch Group FAIR, based in New York. FAIR also publishes a bi-monthly magazine called Extra. For subscription information, you can call the following toll-free number, 1-800-847-3993. That's 1-800-847-3993. Be sure to tell them that you heard about Extra here on Counterspin. You can listen to Counterspin at FAIR's website at www.fair.org. This show was engineered by Kelly Spivey at Mercer Media and co-hosted by Peter Hart and myself, Steve Rendell. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.